Welcome to Idaho Matters. I'm Tom Michael, your guest host, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. President Joe Biden is on his first international trip as chief executive. After years in the Senate, he's got deep international policy experience, and his party is hopeful that experience will help mend fences. And as always, China looms large, and it's the focus of a recent bill just out of the Senate. One of the areas the administration is focusing on is technology and the ways it can hold up and stifle democracy around the world. Our guest today has a lot to say on this topic. Steve Feldstein is a senior fellow of democracy, conflict, and governance at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. He has a new book out titled The Rise of Digital Repression: How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. And as you can read in the book foreword, he conducted the research and wrote the manuscript while he was the Frank Church Chair of Public Affairs at Boise State University. He's on the line with us now. Thanks for coming back on Idaho Matters and congrats on the book.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be back here.
So you worked on the book here in Boise. And so why? What was the guiding issue that you were trying to investigate?
Yeah. So I did spend most of my time conceiving of the idea, doing a lot of the desk research before heading out to some of the countries profiled in the book when it came to really trying to understand better how different digital technology trends are affecting politics and governance around the world. And I think, you know, there was a couple kind of questions that really struck me that I wanted to better understand. You alluded at the very beginning to the role of China and the increasing level of competition that democracies are feeling when it comes to China's influence around the world. And that was certainly one question that was upfront in terms of really trying to examine what does China mean when it comes to digital technology, and how are the tools that China and other countries are providing, how are those being used to stifle legitimate democracy movements around the world?
Now, there's a really provocative concept you describe in the book. It's called the dictator's digital dilemma. What is that?
Yeah, no, it's really the idea and the question about to what extent can autocratic leaders balance the need for control of the internet and of information while also allowing enough innovation to flourish so you can have economies that will grow. And so a lot of countries find themselves in this sort of messy middle where on the one hand, places like Thailand say, we need to make sure that we can see all the data going in and we can surveil and censor ideas that are challenges to our regime. On the other hand, they also know that if they push too far and they put in place too many restrictions in terms of how the internet works, that international companies will pull out and that their economies will suffer as a result. And so they have to be very careful to balance one with the other.
Speaking of the balancing, you say for this dictator's digital dilemma, you say that China has done well in dealing with this by offering a trade for its people. What are the Chinese people gaining and what are they giving up?
Yeah, China represents sort of the big exception to the dilemma in the sense that China has a big enough economy and market and the ability and a large enough industrial capacity so that they can essentially get around these restrictions. So in other words, China says these are the rules that companies need to abide by when they operate in our market. We will censor certain topics. We will enact surveillance as we need to. And if you don't like that, then you don't have to play. And so companies like Google have chosen to leave the market. But what China has done as a result, because it's so big and it has so much capacity, is that it has developed homegrown alternatives like WeChat and so forth. So China is an example where if a country is large enough and has enough geopolitical influence and technological capacity, they can find themselves a solution to this dilemma.
We're talking with Steve Feldstein, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is where he is now. And, you know, you've gone all over the world for this book, Thailand, Ethiopia, Philippines. Does anyone stand out among that group, perhaps the worst aggressors when it comes to digital repression of their people?
Well, what was interesting is each one presented a slightly different case study, and they were all kind of troubling in their own ways. I thought that the Philippines in particular was an interesting case because the Philippines is a country that is a democracy. While it's weak and there's now a populist leader in place who's done a lot of bad things, it's still a country that has elections that are relatively free and fair, and it has a generally strong democratic tradition to it. And so what's interesting is that the head of state in the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has systematically used disinformation as a means to both push out pro-government narratives, many of which are false, and to systematically disparage, intimidate, and harass government critics. And so as a result, he has been able to really promote his own governance objectives while actually relying primarily on social media and disinformation narratives as a means to do so. And that, I think, is really unusual and also presents a model that other weak democracies, places like India, Hungary, Brazil, potentially can emulate as their autocratic leaders think of new ways that they can try to stay in power without sort of resorting to traditional repression techniques, mass imprisonments, and so forth. So to me, that was sort of a disturbing pattern, and actually one where there's some eerie parallels that we've seen in the United States as well.
Yeah, how frightening that Duterte could be a model for anything such as that. We're speaking again with Steve Feldstein. He's from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. The new book is The Rise of Digital Repression. So, Steve, I imagine you can't write any book about technology without talking about artificial intelligence. How does AI play into this?
Yeah, well, AI presents a lot of new capabilities that provide, tools that governments potentially can use to really offer advantages that they previously didn't have. So a good example is how China has incorporated big data and AI technologies when it comes to the persecution of its Uyghur minority in Xinjiang province and in the country. And what they've done is that they've really tried to map out and trace and track almost every citizen in that in that part of the country, in that territory. And it's incorporated and used these mass surveillance tools combined with widespread imprisonment to essentially put together a digital lockdown of the entire region. And that's just unprecedented in terms of incorporating this type of data and these techniques in a way that has really led to the mass curtailment of political freedoms.
So is it geodata? I'm sorry, is it geodata? How do they target that?
How do they track people?
Yeah.
So what's interesting is many different streams of information. So certainly it's through smartphones and SIM card registration. It's through license plate tracking. It's through they're starting to force people through a mandatory program to take away, to look at their DNA as a way to just track who is related to whom.
Wow.
In terms of the entire population. So it's all these different techniques streamed together that they then analyze, look for patterns, and then use as a means to essentially identify and lock up dissenters.
The book, again, The Rise of Digital Repression. You know, you talk about Thailand, Ethiopia, Philippines. What's interesting about this, in each of those chapters, you have a section entitled, well, what about China's role? A lot of blame is placed on China in regards to these other countries. And what are their connections?
Yeah. So China's role, I think, is interesting. And I think there's two ways to look upon it. On the one hand, China has provided a real model when it comes to how these digital technologies can be used for repressive objectives. And so people know very well the leadership about how censorship plays out in China, how surveillance is used. And these offer ideas for their own countries in terms of tactics. But the other point I wanted to make was that the China model only goes so far, and that ultimately decisions on the ground are based on politics and individual leaders' own calculus. And so, they will look at a variety of factors when deciding, well, does it make sense to install a mass surveillance system? How much do I want to invest in high technology as a way to control people versus using more low-tech techniques, whether it's, arresting journalists or passing cyber libel laws or something along those lines. And so I think that's important to know that China provides sort of a broader model for people to think about, but ultimately decisions on the ground are based on leaders and their own institutions and their own political calculations.
You know, I believe we first spoke on the air with you during the first international trip of the last administration. I believe it was Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, mm-hmm. who was pushing overseas. Now it's President Biden on his first international trip. From your perspective, when it comes to technology and democracy and this current president, what does he need to accomplish to deal with these issues of repression?
Well, he's right now, one of the big priorities of the trip between the G7, meeting with a variety of different leaders in Europe, is to push together a multilateral alliance and a set of agreed upon strategies in which to confront these authoritarian trends, including the digital technology side, but more broadly. And so I think one of the first points that's necessary is to bring together clear agreement and a consensus about how to move forward and how to confront the authoritarian resurgence, whether it's looking specifically at China's actions or more broadly saying, look at all these different autocrats who are doing terrible things to their people, including Putin and Russia. How do we come up with a strategy through sanctions, through pressure, through other means in which to push back and ensure that democratic values will persist globally? Mm.
You know, it's not often that a book you've been working on for years has such topicality, such timeliness. The Senate passed the bipartisan technology bill to compete with China. I imagine your interview list will get long. Any thoughts on the success of that bill or what the impact might be on that technology bill?
Yeah, you know, it's an important start. And I think it's something that, you know, it's rarely bipartisan at a moment where there's a lot of polarization. So I think it's both signals to rivals around the world that when it comes to certain issues, the U.S. is approaching those in lockstep. That's a really good thing. And then second of all, the substance of the bill is really important, both in terms of authorizing new funds for investments in critical technologies, as well as ensuring that some of the issues when it comes to supply chains, when it comes to semiconductors, when it comes to general U.S. competitiveness, that these are things that the U.S. is committed to investing in. And I think that sends a really important message about where the U.S. sits when it comes to this geopolitical rivalry.
Well, this has been great. Thanks for helping us cover such ground. We've been speaking with Steve Feldstein about his new book, The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. And coming up next, the unknown history of the Horse Queen of Idaho. I'm Tom Michael, and you're in tune with Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio News.